Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is that we just found the world's oldest cheese. It was found in an ancient Egyptian tomb, and it was made from cow milk and either sheep or goat milk mixed together, and it was found in a broken clay jar from the 13th century BC in Egypt, which is kind of cool. It's a city called Memphis. And chemists at the University of Catania in Italy used mass spectrometry to analyze the antique cheese, which basically looked like a piece of soap that weighed several hundred grams. So we have 3,200-year-old cheese. And we actually figured out that their cheese had bacteria that caused an infection called brucellosis in it. So our cheese making has come a little bit further along. We don't really have that disease in the U.S. anymore, but it affects hundreds of thousands of people and animals worldwide today, and it looks like the flu. It's not that you really need to worry about that, but it's kind of interesting to note that we've been using dairy fat in our diet for a very, very long time, and we're still around.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's guest is an amazing human being, a dear friend, a former guest on the show, an 11-time New York Times best-selling author, and internationally recognized leader, speaker, and educator in the field of functional medicine. He's the Pritzker Foundation Chair in Functional Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, and an all-around just amazing helping human who has done more to change the face of modern Western medicine to make it more functional than anyone else I know. None other than Dr. Mark Hyman. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Good to be back.
The last time I interviewed you was about the doctor's pharmacy, where you were talking about how to use food as medicine. And we talked about why you might want to eat some fat and some meat. And we talked about the dangers of fructose going back a couple years in 2014. Mark, what's changed in medicine since we first talked 4 years ago?
Oh my goodness, so many changes are happening. We are actually in an extraordinary scientific revolution that is finally breaking through to mainstream medicine. And the microbiome is one of the profound wedges in the system that's changing the paradigm, where we see how the gut flora affects your immune system. It can cause depression, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's, autism. And we're learning that the way we think about disease doesn't make sense anymore. And I've been at Cleveland Clinic in the last 4 years, and it's a traditional medical system. But within that system, people are realizing that the way we think about disease has to change. The way we deliver care has to change. And we're seeing people coming out of the woodwork wanting to work with us. I just talked to a cardiologist there who wants to study keto diets versus Mediterranean, look at all the metabolic effects. And we're just seeing an incredible openness to this paradigm shift that's happening, more than I've seen in 30 years of doing this.
In addition to all of your writing and your Broken Brain docuseries and your work with some of the leading
I would call them skeptical physicians in the world who are less skeptical because of trying your stuff. You just launched Doctor's Pharmacy, your new podcast, which is doing really well. And it's that kind of success that led me to profile you in my new book, Game Changers, where I looked at almost 500 people who had big impacts on the world to say, what are the common elements amongst them? And one of the things that stands out from you, just in that data-driven analysis, is you have this really big, kind of compassionate, giving heart that you don't find in every doctor. Why are you like that?
You know, that is a great question, Dave. I remember being 3 years old and just wanting to love everybody and hug everybody. And I was like noticing that all these grown-ups were just so not into it and were so disconnected from their hearts. And it was just so painful for me. And I have that feeling that's never gone away. And I still feel like that. And I don't actually know where it came from. I think I was sort of born with it. But I do have a sense that the world, you know, there's a Hebrew phrase. It's called tikkun olam, which means repairing the world or healing the world. And I think it's something that just kind of got in my DNA. And also I studied Buddhism back in college, and the whole notion of compassion and understanding the way that our ego gets in the way of our actually being in the world to create love and connection and change and growing and learning, that, you know, it sort of shaped what I do and everything I do.
Tell me about what you did in Haiti.
Well, like everybody else, I saw the news of the earthquake, and I just finished reading a book about Paul Farmer, who revolutionized care in Haiti, in the poorest place on the planet, other than in the Western Hemisphere. And he created an extraordinary impression on me through that book. And then the earthquake happened in Haiti, and a series of events happened that allowed me to put together a team. A patient with a private jet flew us down, and we were the first on the ground in the major hospital in Port-au-Prince and delivered to trauma care to the 300,000 people who were injured. There were 300,000 dead. And through that process, you know, I began to think about how we need to apply a different model of care to chronic disease. Because I was shocked to learn that the major diseases in the hospital weren't malaria or TB or AIDS. They were heart disease and diabetes and hypertension and kidney failure. And I was like, whoa. And I began to realize that these are social diseases and we need a social cure. And that led to me developing a program with a faith-based healthy living curriculum in church in Southern California, Saddleback, with Rick Warren, where we got 15,000 people to lose 250,000 pounds by doing it together in groups and supporting each other, loving each other. I kind of call it the love diet.
There are somewhere around 250,000 people will hear this episode. We're about to cross 100 million downloads this year. And some of them are, they got it. They've been doing this for a while. They're kicking ass. And there's a big group of people who are saying, maybe I think this is possible, but I'm not there yet. And what I want you to share with people today is, after all of this time doing that amazing, you know, first responder, drop everything, show up where there's a disaster, and you know, be a doctor and watch what's happening. From that perspective, and also just from seeing the thousands of patients that go through Ultra Wellness Center, what can the people who are almost there, like they're on the path to just having limitless energy and having no pain in their bodies and having brains that work as much as they want them to, what can you share that's just critically important for those people? They've taken a first step. There's another step coming.
Well, I think, you know, it's important for everybody to ask themselves what matters to them, what they care about, what they want for themselves, for their life, for their way of being in the world, and connect to that, because that leads to a whole series of decisions and behaviors that actually allow you to make choices to enhance your health, to improve your well-being, and be curious about how do you live a more powerful, integrated life where you inhabit your body, you inhabit your mind, you inhabit your emotional life in a way that creates power and energy and vitality and impact, and that you're able to show up in your life and love your family and love your partner and be engaged in the work that you do and do all the things that really matter for people, instead of walking around like zombies in a brain fog. So I just ask people to check in with themselves and ask them what really matters, connect with that, and then what are the decisions that flow from that?
So it's sort of the why you do what you do, and that actually leads you to make better decisions with food.
Yeah.
When you were writing Food Pharmacy, you touched on some stuff that's really important to me.
You mean food, what the heck should I eat?
Yeah, sorry, Food Pharmacy.
Doctor's Pharmacy with an F.
Yeah.
Is my podcast. Okay.
Clearly, I need some more Bulletproof Coffee.
It's late in the afternoon. We just had some sushi. It's okay.
Yeah, we're at a conference, actually, the Archangel Conference, recording this live, so there may be some background noise as well. And we've just spent a few hours hanging out and chatting. So it was a great time to just sit down and pick your brain some more for listeners. When you were writing What the Heck Should I Eat, you talked about not just what food does to people, but what food does to the environment around us. Mm-hmm. And Kimball Musk was on the show, and you know, we talked about his work in that space and how there's a revolution in grass-fed agriculture and fresh and local. What are the bigger impacts, other than what you get in your brain, from when someone eats? What are the bigger impacts that you discovered when you're writing your book?
Well, you know, the podcast, The Doctor's Pharmacy, came out of things that I learned that I knew about, but really got into in writing the book, Food, What the Heck Should I Eat, which is that food matters to everything that matters. It matters to our health. It matters to the economy. It matters to the environment, to climate, to social justice issues, to poverty, to violence, to kids' ability to learn, even national security. And most people don't connect food to all these things. So how does that work? And I began to unpack that. And I'm writing another book that really goes even deeper into this. I included some in the book, but food clearly causes chronic disease. It's the number one cause of our chronic disease epidemic, which affects 1 in 2 people. 1 in 2 people have prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. It also clearly affects the economy. Medicare and Medicaid are the biggest drivers of our federal deficit, and by 2040, 100% of our entire federal tax revenue will be required to pay for Medicaid and Medicare at our current rates. It's bankrupting businesses. You know, Starbucks spends more on healthcare than on coffee. GM spends more on healthcare than on steel. So it's really troubling. And in fact, globally, there's going to be $47 trillion, which is the GDP of the 6 largest nations combined, we spend on chronic lifestyle preventable disease in the next 20 years. So economic burden. And then environmental stuff. And I didn't really understand the global impact of this. I did know that 1/5 of our fossil fuels is used for growing food and transporting food for human consumption. I did know that, you know, industrial factory farm animals contribute methane and carbon in the environment. I did understand those things, but I didn't really grasp the fact that the food system as a whole is the number one solution for reversing climate change, that we can draw down carbon in the environment to pre-industrial times by dealing with food waste. 40% of our food is wasted, and that goes into landfills and creates methane. We use tilling in the soil, which causes soil erosion. We've depleted tens of feet of topsoil in America. We've hit so much, thank God, but we're mining our soil. Within 50 years, we're not going to have any soil. We're using the agricultural methods that allow this erosion instead of actually building soil, which can then sequester and hold carbon. We're not using regenerative agriculture practices. We're not using regenerative and restorative practices for animal husbandry. So we can actually, using regenerative grazing practices, take down carbon as well. And factory farms are one of the biggest contributors to climate change and methane. So all these things together can have huge impact. And then you look at just the environmental degradation. The runoffs from nitrogen in the waterways is causing dead zones because the nitrogen fertilizes the algae and it suffocates all the fish and the animals in the ocean and the lakes and rivers, and that goes in the ocean. And you have a dead zone the size of New Jersey and the Gulf of Mexico, and all the pesticides and the GMO glyphosate is a Roundup made by Monsanto for soybeans. It's sprayed on all their wheat products, even though they're not GMO, because it exfoliates them before harvest. And they were just fined $289 million by a court in California because of the fact that they found it caused cancer, that they knew it from their internal records, and that they denied it, and they got punitive damages of $250 million. There's 5,000 similar lawsuits going on now around Monsanto. So environmental degradation, climate change, and then poverty and social justice. You know, most people don't understand that the food that we eat affects our behavior, affects our mood, our cognitive function. Violence. We know, for example, from studies that in prisons, with violent prisoners, If you give them a healthy diet, you reduce violent crime in prisons by 56%. If you add a multivitamin, it reduces it by 80%. They're nutritionally deficient. Dave, I remember I was in my office one day and I got a letter, a handwritten letter from a prisoner in prison who said, I read your book, Ultra Metabolism. This was like 13 years ago. And he said, I realized that my violent behavior was a direct result of the food that I was eating. And I feel like a different person right now when he changed his diet. So we see violence. We see the cycle of poverty and dysfunction. You look at the developmental effects of a poor diet and processed food and sugar and additives on kids and their brain development. They can't function in school. We know that there's an achievement gap, that kids who are in school and going to breakfast with soda and Doritos or Flaming Hot Chips, they can't focus, they can't function. And when you change that, it transforms them. I remember talking to this guy who started charter school in Washington, D.C., in one of the poorest areas of the city, with these disadvantaged kids all on welfare eating garbage, and he fed them three meals a day. These kids now are going to Harvard and Yale, and all the white kids in the other neighborhoods want to send their kids to this school. So it is a profound effect on our kids and behavior. And even national security, we now have 70% of our military recruits. I met with General Jack Keane, who was the head of Desert Storm and the Army Division, the tanks. And he told me, Mark, we have 70% of our military recruits are not fit to be accepted into the military. So we have, across the spectrum of our society, everything that matters, health, the economy, climate, national security, environment, kids, education, poverty, social justice, violence. I mean, we know from records that have been released through FOIA, emails from Coca-Cola and other companies, that they are deliberately targeting the poor. I was asked to give the speech at the anniversary of Martin Luther King's death in Harlem at the Riverside Church. Governor Cuomo was there and others, and I got the last speech. And I shared about how our food system is a system of oppression that keeps the poor down and disadvantaged. It's a vicious cycle. So we really have to look at food in a much broader context than our own personal choices, than our own health, which is important, but it's really matters. And what you put on your fork every day is the single most important thing you do to affect yourself and the world around you. And it's empowering, because if what I'm saying is true, and it is.
It sure is.
If it's true, then the implications are we as consumers have choice. You know, I had breakfast with the CEO of Nestle's the other day in Canada, who used to be the head of food, president of food in the US for Nestle's. And you know, it was remarkable how the consumer movements around food are driving their decisions and behavior. For example, they stopped being part of Grocery Manufacturers of America,
yes,
which is a trade association of all the big food companies.
That was a Monsanto front group. It's not.
Well, no, it's but you know, we were talking because he said that, you know, we decided to quit that group because they were trying to slow, by opposition, any positive change. They were trying to oppose GMO labeling. They were trying to oppose soda tax. They were opposing things in ways that were often illegal, and they actually got fined for what they were doing, like through a lawsuit, like I think $17 million. And then a bunch of companies, like Unilever, Campbell's, Nestle's, all jumped out of that and created a new alliance to actually move things forward. He told me the things that people don't even know, that they stopped marketing foods to kids, which is phenomenal, but people don't know about that. They're starting to do regenerative agriculture. They're looking at nutrigenomics. They're changing the product formulations. They're fighting regulations that prevent them from reformulating their products, like lean cuisine, which has to be low fat, which they don't want to be anymore. So our choices matter, and these companies change their behavior based on what we do, what we buy, and what we say and think.
That is so
powerful. Sorry, that was a long speech.
No, it's all real. And
that was my short version.
I've met with presidents from some of the larger companies as well, and they're worried because what they used to do, they could tell themselves, oh, this is good for people, these, you know, sugar water, yeah, no problem. But the sales are dropping because people are paying attention. They're hearing your work, reading your work, listening to podcasts and things like that, and saying, you know, I'm just going to change my behavior for me, but the impact of doing the right thing for you is that if no one will buy the crap, no one's going to try and sell it to people who don't know any better.
Yeah.
And we're seeing a bigger shift in the last 3 years than I than I ever imagined would happen in that period of time.
Yeah.
And in large part, it happens because of spending, but it also happens because you come at this from an just impeccable, highly credentialed, highly experienced, credible mindset.
Really, I didn't tell you I got my medical degree online. I just paid $50 and I got that.
But I mean, you walk in there and you talk with them, and it's not the 1970s coconut oil is a deadly poison kind of BS that maybe that caused their product strategy a long time ago. So I feel like now is the time to do it. But
you know, what's also interesting is the food companies responded to the dietary guidelines.
Yes.
So they were only doing what the government told them to do. Eat low fat, take out this, don't put in that, less salt. And they were just responding to try to do the right thing. And there were all these unintended consequences. And I'm not defending the food companies, because there were some intended consequences. Oh, yeah. And some of their behavior is egregious. And like, for example, targeting minorities by Coke and so forth. But the fact that these big monsters are changing their behavior based on what we do as individuals is something I want everybody to understand. You vote 3 times a day with your fork, and that matters. And what you eat matters, and where you buy your food matters, and how you make choices around what you're eating is enormously important. And these companies then have the power. You know, like Walmart says, we don't want trans fat in anything. All their vendors have to change because they're one of the biggest outlets for their product. Or they say, we don't want as much cardboard and packaging. Or if these big food companies say to their big ag companies, we don't want you to have GMO, or we don't want you to, you know, make high fructose corn syrup and everything. And they'll start to change what they're doing. If we want regenerative agriculture, if we want organic. And right now we need those big companies to help push the marketplace, because unless we actually realize that the way things change is by scale, it's not going to change. In other words, if the biggest food company in the world says to their agricultural producers, we only want regenerative agriculture, we want you to change your soil practices, we want no-till farming, we don't want you to use these drugs or these, you know, I went to this conference once. It was like an ag conference. I don't know why they invited me to speak. And this guy I sat next to I said, what do you do? He says, well, I'm in plant medicine. I'm like, plant medicine? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, we make pesticides.
That's not what I thought.
And the other guy sitting next to me was Mr. Cargill.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, what's going on here? Who invited me to this party?
The fact that you're willing to go to those parties and crash them is one of the reasons.
I was invited. I wasn't even crashed.
you can just tell from MJ, like, you're one of the game changers. That's why I included you in the new book, because I want people to know what's going on inside your mind and the habits and things that you do. And so one of the laws, your story is in there, the laws about how people behave. And the book, Game Changers, is on Amazon for pre-sale right now. And so I want to dig a little...
Pretty awesome.
Oh, thank you. I want to dig a little bit deeper into what goes through your mind when you're sitting down next to Mr. Cargill and Mr. Pesticide. I mean, do you get pissed off at these guys? Do you feel sorry for them? Like, what's up?
It goes back to your first question, which is, you know, I lead with love.
Okay.
And compassion.
You always show up that way wherever I've seen you. Okay.
And these are human beings.
Yeah.
Everybody's exactly. A human being before they're Republican, conservative, whether they're, you know, Monsanto, exactly. Or whether they're, you know, like Whole Foods. They're all human beings. And they have their beliefs and their attitudes, and it's fine. We may disagree, but I always lead with building a heart connection with somebody, an authentic relationship, and having a real conversation and inquiring and asking instead of, like, you know, grandstanding and pounding them with my beliefs. I'm like, I'm curious, like, what is this for you? What do you think of this? What about these issues? What about this fact? And we start to have a dialogue, and it's a dynamic, engaging, real conversation. Like, I don't have any illusions that, you know, that they are necessarily going to agree with me or do anything to change what they're doing. But a lot of it for me is being curious about how do they think, right? You know, what did Lincoln say? Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Right.
I don't exactly say them as my enemies, but I think, you know, I think it's like, I don't know the number exactly, but I think it's like an $18 trillion global food industry. And it's the biggest industry on the planet. And it's not going away. So we have to figure out how to push it in the right direction.
And hating on it isn't how to push it in the right direction.
No.
And my experience with these people is when I first started getting to know, you know, people running really big, $1 billion plus food things, making decisions. And as Bulletproof's growing, I realized so many of the things that I want to do, there are regulations preventing me from doing it. Right. And that is not cool. And none of us like it. And even the companies who are doing what I would consider nutritional harm and environmental harm to the world, when you talk to the executives, they do not say, oh yeah, we're doing that, ha ha ha, but we're rolling in the bucks. There's no mindset like that. They believe they're feeding the world. They believe they're doing the right thing because they have the facts wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So it's changing their mindset. But when they change their mindset, hey, most of them have kids and grandkids. They want to create that same kind of a world. So it's just a matter of getting the knowledge that we now have into their hands, letting it soak in, and creating a world where, well, if you don't do that, no one buys your stuff. So you have to do the right thing. And one of the areas that I'm most passionate about is in grass-fed agriculture.
Yeah.
Because...
Dave, did I tell you I'm thinking of starting a grass-fed ranch in Colorado?
Are you really?
Yeah.
So I have I have four sheep and two pigs on my small organic farm. And I can tell you, where the sheep poop, the grass is insane. And where the sheep don't poop, the grass is okay. And there are people who say, well, you can't eat animals, it's bad for the environment. Eating industrial animals is unethical. It tortures the animal. You're going to get toxins from glyphosate. You're going to get all sorts of bad stuff. It's bad for the world. And if you do that, you're supporting, you're voting with your dollar to say, please destroy more topsoil. Please overgraze. Please do all the bad things that happen when you have corn and soy-fed animals. But if you're eating less meat, which is good for you, but not no meat, and super high-quality, grass-fed, local stuff, you're now decentralizing agriculture. You're creating healthier soil in more places on the planet. And
restoring ecosystems and sequestering carbon. And what I didn't realize is that now we drain 1.3 trillion gallons more every year out of the Oglala Aquifer, which is the biggest aquifer in America that basically irrigates the entire agricultural base in the Midwest, than it's being faster than it's being replenished from rainfall. And so we're going to run out of water and soil in 50 years. And when you actually change the form of agriculture from to no-till, which means you don't dig up the soil so it erodes, and you use regenerative grazing practices, you actually sequester carbon and you sequester water. So you literally, the reason we're having droughts and floods is because of how we farm.
Yes.
And putting the water back in the soil and putting the carbon back in the soil creates a sustainable model of food production for the next, you know, thousands of years.
We didn't learn from the Dust Bowl, which happened in the 1910s, 1920s, somewhere around there. And we destroyed a bunch of our topsoil, and we've been continuing to do it, but now we spray poison on top of the soil. And
you know what happened with the Dust Bowl? They killed 100, like, what was that? They killed like 60 million buffalo.
Yeah, they got rid of the animals that poop on the soil.
Yeah, and then the soil, and then they started the agricultural practices, and that's what led to this.
And it's happening again, but when we make a decision to say, I'm going to go to the farmer's market and buy a couple pounds of grass-fed beef that supported my local soil, less fuel was used to feed it, less fuel was used to transport it, no environmental destruction happened, no bunnies lost their homes because of a big tractor making soybeans for your
turf runoff, for fertilizers for the soybean and the corn, all those things, yeah.
The definition of biohacking, when I wrote it, was changing the environment around you and inside of you so that you have full control of your own biology. And it's easy to think about taking a bite of food and changing the environment inside of you, because that's a big thing to do. But when you realize that there's secondary impacts on the environment around you, you choose food that might make you okay, but that lessens the environment around you, over time your performance will necessarily decline. So top three things people can do if they want to do something that makes them have more energy now and supports the environment around you.
Whoa, top three things. I thought you were saving that for the end.
This is my first of 50 top three things.
Okay, so in terms of your personal health, environmental health, and climate change, and economic health, and social health, the aspiration is to eat in a way that restores your health, restores the environment, restores our social fabric. And that means eating real food. It means eating minimally processed food or not processed food. It means being conscious about how your food is grown. When you can, you can't always be perfect, but if you can, as much as possible, eat food from local organic farms, from no-till farms, if you can eat regeneratively grown animal food, if you can understand the linkages between these things, you're going to restore your health, you're going to restore the healthy environment, the climate, the economy, improve our social fabric, reduce social injustice, just by what you put in your mouth.
Mark, earlier I mentioned Game Changers, the new book, and boiled down 46 laws of people who perform better. And what I found from looking at the data, from asking that question you just mentioned, is that there were sort of three big buckets that people who did world-changing things did. And they wanted to be smarter. They wanted their brains to work better. They wanted to be faster. They wanted the rest of their biology to work really well and to get the things done. And they also wanted to be happier. And the data is really conclusive that the people who are happier and actually work on their happiness perform better. And people can find the book. You just Google or go to Amazon and search for Bulletproof Game Changers, and you'll find the book. But of those three things around being smarter, being faster, being happier, what do you do for happiness in your own life?
That's a great question. And I think it may sound esoteric, but the reason that most of us suffer is because of our beliefs and what they lead to in terms of our perceptions of any situation, and then what that makes us feel like, right? So often our beliefs are determined by experiences and things we've had that we generalize to everything. For example, when I was a kid, I had a stepfather who had a rage problem. And one day I was 7 or 8 years old. My mother said, we didn't have garburators back then, you know, or garbage disposal. So she said, take the soup that's left over and throw it down the toilet. And my stepfather was a clean freak. And I threw the soup down the toilet. I flushed the toilet. I walked out of the bathroom. He's like, did you wash your hands? I'm like, no, because I just flushed the soup down the toilet. And I told the truth. And he went into a rage. He picked me up. He threw me across the room against the wall. And it traumatized me so that I learned that it wasn't safe to tell the truth because I would get in trouble.
Wow.
And unpacking that and understanding that and saying that there was another explanation for that. That the explanation was that he was a rageaholic, that he had an anger problem, that he was a clean freak, that he, in that situation, that's what happened. But that's not necessarily how everyone and everything is going to react. And so once I began to realize that, I was like, well, I can be more direct. I can be more honest. I can get rid of that belief that was causing me to have relationships that didn't go as well as I'd like because I wasn't able to say what I really felt or thought or needed. So that's just one example.
How old were you when you figured that out and unpacked it?
When I really did?
Yeah.
I mean, I knew it, but the behavior was so ingrained. It was really only until the last few years when I worked with someone who helped me unpack my beliefs. It's this woman named Shelley Lefko. She's got this crazy little practice of belief work.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful. And I think, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, we know that your suffering is directly related to your perception of a situation and what you believe about it, whether it's true or not. And so, I, you know, working on that level of your beliefs is a powerful way to get happiness. So the other thing that's really important is this notion of service. So most of us are out there doing things for ourselves, trying to get ahead, trying to make ourselves healthier and ourselves smarter and ourselves faster and ourselves happier. But at the end of the day, the science really shows that when you serve others, when you are altruistic, when you are engaged in helping others, that it creates more happiness, more pleasure, more fulfillment, yes. And that building the social network and the social relationships and the connections, not what can I get from so-and-so, but what can I give to so-and-so. And I know you do that. I do that. We both do that. And it actually leads to a much happier life. So what's the secret of happiness? It's parking your ego at the door, being of service, and working on your beliefs.
Those all showed up consistently among high performers in the data set behind Game Changers. And so those are parts of different laws. And the idea is there's 46 different laws that everyone does. So you can prioritize where you want to put your energy first. But you said something that's just super profound. You're 50 something?
58.
You're 58, all right. So you went 55 years.
And I'm a slow learner.
No, you're not. This is the thing. You've written 11 New York Times bestsellers. You've changed the face of functional medicine. And you're causing great good in the world. And you were still running on programming that happened when you were a child.
Yeah. I mean, I worked on it for years.
Yeah.
But until I've gotten better at it, but until I really unpacked that story, and that's just one example, and I have many, many of those.
We all do.
And I was able to actually free up, and I'm like, okay. And I, you know, the less I do for me, the more I do for others, the more I kind of let my, I don't know what the word is, not personal needs, but it's
ego.
Like my ego at the door, and just show up and just be love and just be kind and just serve, things work out. And if I am doing something, it's not usually for me. You know, like this book I'm writing about the food system, or the podcast I do, or the work I do at Cleveland Clinic, or the work with my patients. It's all about what can I do for you.
Yeah,
and then it feeds me. It comes back a thousandfold.
If you write a book for yourself, no one's going to want to read it. That's just how it works. And the reason it's so profound that you can talk about that is that everyone listening to the show, and me too, I had lots of the stuff I had to work through in my own patterns. You learn these lessons before you can think about them, and then just show up in your decisions, in your relationships, in your business, with your friends. In everything you do, and they're entirely invisible. When did you first know? So you really got through this a couple years ago. When did you first go, wow, this is an issue for me? Were you 20? Were you 30?
I probably was in my 30s, maybe, when I first realized it. But, you know, there's different things that have happened.
Yeah.
You know, there's a few things that have happened that, for me personally, that have really affected my way of being and my belief in myself. And they were epiphanies that happened in my life in different circumstances that I didn't really like learn. They just like were lessons that showed up. One was when I was 18, because I was kind of a weird kid, and I was a little nerdy, and I read books and didn't have a lot of friends, and people made fun of me. And I went out west, and I was after high school, and I was backpacking, and I was camping with these guys, and they were kind of making fun of me. And I, you know, I would get very hurt. I was very sensitive. And then I just had this epiphany that, you know, maybe in what they're saying, there's a nugget for me to learn and reflect on, or it's their own nonsense and bullshit, and they just have to work through, and I have to have compassion for whatever their issue or suffering is. And that was huge. The second thing was probably about 4 or 5 years later. I remember, you know, being a little anxious about what was happening in my life, what was going to happen, how I was going to figure out, or whether this was going to happen. And I just remember having this moment, this epiphany, where I just realized that if I reframe my way of being to trusting that everything was going to work out, that I would be better off, that I just could literally have this sense of faith that everything that was happening to me was the right thing in that moment, even if it wasn't great, like that there was some part of the path. And I can look back now 50 years and I can go, oh, I get how everything's connected. In retrospect, I understand the linkages between all the events in my life that led to who I am in this moment, which is exactly what I wanted be doing and where I want to be. So that was the second thing. The third thing was sort of realizing that, and this came a little bit later, because I think early on I was sort of out to prove that I was okay and prove that I could be successful and prove to my dad, you know, and do all the things that we often do. And once I sort of got out of my own way and I go, this isn't for me. Like, I'm not here to serve me. I'm here to be a service in the world and to love and just show up. I don't get stressed at all anymore. Yeah. Like, I never get stressed. And I'm like in the most awful situations and think people are horrible as things are happening. And I'm like, and sometimes I, you know, there's some personal thing, like with a family member, I might get a big feeling, but most of the time, like, and my wife's like, how, like, you know, the plane we miss, or this happens, or I'm like, whatever, it's all going to work out. And I just don't have connection to anxiety around worry and stress. And
not now, but you did before.
I did. Yeah, I did. You know, last year I got really, really, really sick. And I think it even took me another level deep into it.
I was worried about you.
Yeah, Dave, you were helping me. I appreciate it. I'm like, Dave, what do I do? I'm dying. And I, you know, I'm a skinny guy. I'm like, you know, 6'3", 185 pounds. And I was down to 157 pounds, almost 30 pounds lighter. I couldn't work. I had rip-roaring inflammation throughout my body. And my colon was completely inflamed from top to bottom. I couldn't really eat. I was nauseous, 24/7 pain. It was unrelenting in my gut. And I couldn't think. I couldn't focus. I couldn't work. I literally could go from my bed to the bathroom back and forth 20 times a day. And I didn't have my brain. I didn't have any emotional capacity. I didn't have my body. And I'm like, I was actually all okay with it all. And I was peaceful within it because I felt like I had this sense of who I was in a spiritual way that was this sort of ever-present, you know, eternal part of myself that I was resting in. And I just was surrendered in that state. And I didn't know if I was going to die. I didn't know if I was going to live. And many people thought I was going to die. And I realized that, you know, there's no reason to worry about anything. Like, I could just be in the peace of just being in that experience. And it sounds crazy, but I wasn't fighting it. And I just surrendered to it. And that surrender is really how I live my life. Like, I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know what's going to show up. But I pay attention. And I look at the signs. And I watch what comes into my life and who comes into my life. And then I go with it. Like, you know, it's like that. I talk about it on my podcast with Michael Beckwith, but it's like that joke about the guy who's like drowning and, you know, he's praying to God to save him. And this boat comes by and he's like, no, I'm waiting for God. And submarine comes by and no, I'm waiting. The helicopter comes by with the rope. He's like, no, I'm waiting for God. And then he dies and drowns. And he goes, God, why did you forsake me? He says, what do you mean? I sent a boat. I sent a plane. I sent a helicopter, a submarine, you know. And I think it's important to be alert to what's actually happening. And those are the lessons for me, and it may be different for everybody else, that have really helped me surrender, to drop my ego, to be in love and compassion, to be honest and truthful in my relationships and experiences, and to just trust.
It's amazing that we can go from talking about food and social injustice to what...
That was soul food we were talking about.
It was. But the ability to speak your truth, even though you got programmed early on to not speak your truth and to walk the path that got you there, by sharing that and just being vulnerable enough to do that as, you know, a smart leader in different fields, I'm hoping that inspires listeners to say, well, if a guy like Mark had to go through that stuff, whatever they have gone through in their own path probably isn't nearly as bad as they think it is. And if they haven't dealt with it, and they don't, they will not show up in the world the way they can. And a big motivation for me in starting Bulletproof was that I wanted to write down all the stuff someone should have told me when I was 20.
Yeah.
And food, like
when, so when you wrote about Game Changers, you mean?
And when I started Bulletproof, the blog, and I started doing the podcast, and Game Changers is the analysis of what 450 people have said matters most. Yeah. That's data driven and quantified and turned into rules and little, you know, actions you can take, as well as little questionnaires and quizzes that tell you whether you should do this first or do something else first. But where do you focus your effort to become a better, higher performing human being? Instead of saying, I'm going to copy that one guy, because you're not that one guy. But if everyone agrees on something, by the way, everyone agreed on food first. But
really?
Yeah, of course, because it's such a thing it's a linchpin for everything that happens in and around you.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just that. It was that if someone would just have told me in a way I could understand this, maybe I would have looked for my own bad beliefs, the ones you talked about, way earlier in life, instead of just walking around and acting like a jerk. And your story about the guy in prison who changed his life, when I first lost my first 50 of the 100 pounds I've lost, is my early 20s. And I
asked, where'd you lose? Do you want me to help you find it?
No, I can stay wherever I went.
Was it at McDonald's? You dropped it?
I certainly tried it there. That didn't work. But I accidentally went gluten-free. And I was...
Accidentally?
I mean, I didn't know about gluten back then. But I was trying to eat more protein and less carbs. So I just cut out grains. And when I lost that 50 pounds, it took about 3 months. The other 50 took years to figure out all the other details. But my personality changed, because I'd always been, you know, I'd really developed muscles on my middle finger, and I was an angry. I didn't know I was actually anxious. I was really anxious and just pissed off all the time. And I just thought that was kind of my normal state, and just because everyone around me was so stupid, obviously, right? And even my parents were like,
Dave. It was everybody else's fault.
Of course it was, right? And my parents were like, Dave, your personality just changed. We like you better. And I was like, wow, like yeah. No one had told me this. I didn't want to walk around being an asshole, and I probably felt guilty about it.
I can't say this name of this guy, but he's a very famous guy who was known to be a prick and really awful personality and abusive, but like a very high level government official. And I changed
diet. He lost 50 pounds. And one of his friends, we were walking to dinner with him together, another very prominent guy. I don't know what you did to him, but he's like a whole different person. He's so nice now. I'm like,
you know. It's really funny. I don't know if he'd allow me to say his name on the air. I'm not going to, but he knows what I'm talking about. A very famous band. They invited me to come backstage in Portland with them, and they've been drinking Bulletproof coffee on tour. And they said, why don't you come on the bus and make some coffee? Like, we want to hang out. And I'm like, this is amazing. Like, I'm actually hanging out with rock stars. And the band says, Dave, thank you for Bulletproof coffee. And I said, what do you mean? You like it? And they said, oh, we like it. But the reason we like it the most is that our lead singer is so much nicer to tour with. Like he's a nicer human being, because on tour, musicians they just get beaten up by constant travel and bad food. So by doing this, he actually was nice to his band members in a very different way. But our personalities will change from food. And when you do that, those feelings of compassion that you talked about, those feelings of service, it's much easier to have them when you're not.
I mean, that's right. I mean, that's an important point, is in order to achieve a higher level of being that makes you happy, you have to clear out all the garbage. You have to eat right. You have to exercise. You have to sleep. You have to meditate or do some form of restorative practice. You have to do all those things foundationally. And then your body can actually respond. I always say it's very hard to be enlightened if you're mercury poisoned, or you're, you know, pre-diabetic, or your thyroid's not working, or you're, you know, have gut flora that's messed up, right? It's much harder to be awake. And at the end of the day, that's what we all want. Happiness, be awake, and be fully inhabiting our lives in a way that's powerful and engaged and is game-changing.
Wow, nice plug there. Thanks, Dr. Hyman. Instead of asking you the top three questions that you've answered before, one final question, and you can make the answer short. What is the world of medicine going to look like 20 years from now? Just paint me a very brief picture of it.
Well, what I think is actually happening is a massive paradigm shift. There are a couple of forces happening. One is payment systems are changing. So that means that doctors and healthcare systems will get paid for getting people healthy, not treating people when they're sick. It's called value-based care. And the second is that scientific paradigm is changing. So we have the economic paradigm and the scientific paradigm. And the scientific paradigm is changing because we're understanding the body in a revolutionary new way with the advent of systems biology, with the advent of artificial intelligence and big data. And it's forcing us to rethink disease based on what the root causes are, how the environment interacts with our genes to create who we are, which is all of your work. It's understanding things like mitochondria and gut flora and inflammation and toxicity and nutrition, things that are really absent from medical practice right now, will be the standard of care.
Within 20 years.
I hope. I'm trying to make it faster. It might be longer, but it's inevitable. It's happening. And it's being disrupted in many ways outside of healthcare. I just found out from somebody who sold their company to PayPal for $600 million that was a digital wallet that paid out all kinds of people for different things, and they had different clients. One of them was Google. They have 300,000 people they're paying for doing medical research every month.
Wow.
Like, what is Google doing? It's not a healthcare system. How is it doing medical research? What is it doing? Why are they paying, you know, 300,000 people to be part of medical research every month? That's the kind of stuff that's happening, and it's disruptive and it's exciting, and it gives us the potential to leapfrog ahead of what we're doing. It's like going from the abacus to the iPhone. And I think we're going to be seeing that happen more rapidly than we think.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your podcast, The Doctor's Pharmacy. See, I got the name right?
You did. F-A-R-M-A-C-Y, a place for conversations that matter. You can find it on iTunes and anywhere you find your podcast.
It's if you like Bulletproof Radio, you'll love Mark's show. I've been a guest. And if this was an interesting interview for you, check out Game Changers. Just go to Amazon. You can pre-order it. Just search for Bulletproof Game Changers. And you will find an awesome book and hear more from Mark in there. Mark, thanks again.
I got the book. It's really, I got a pre-copy. It's awesome, really. If you want to know how great people do great things and are happy, check it out.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.